Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast, the podcast where everything is made up and the points don't count. I am your host this week, Ryan Davis. I am not Carlos Porto Carrero, as you might know. Carlos is busy with Fight Club this week, so we just have Isaac Bennett, Joel Reese. We are not only missing Carlos, but we also were going to have a special guest this week, Julie DeCaro of 670 The Score in Chicago, but she's a little under the weather, so she's not able to join us either. So if it sounds like we're just kind of making everything up as we go, that's because we are. Do you guys have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to point out, Ryan, that we had Sarah Spain on a couple weeks ago, and she was sick when she was on the air. So we have a really good track record of making every woman we come in contact with sick. So that's pretty sweet. It's kind of the story of my life, but if we've got a good thing going, let's keep it rolling.
We'll have to check with Kat Garcia and see if we
Yeah, exactly. Right. She seems to be the outlier.
I think Sarah actually said something about the fact that we were sort of naturally repulsive to women, which I won't refute that, but more truth to that than we even realized in the moment.
The shoe fits.
Yeah, we are pretty terrible. And with that, we also got rid of Carlos for the week. So, I guess let's go ahead and start with our first topic that we came up with. I want to toss this first to you, Isaac, because we're talking about your absolute favorite thing in the world, and that is Addison Russell. He's been
an hour later.
Yeah, he's been doing some things this week. I actually have something I wrote about him that I've been working on for a few days about his breakout, but I want to hear your thoughts too. What did you see from Addison Russell this week besides stuff that you – tell me the things you can talk about on the podcast that won't be not safe for work.
I was going to say, I'm flipping through my notes here, and it's like censored.
Oh, there's something.
Let's talk about Babbitt, right? No. But I think it's pretty easy to forget that Addison Russell on April 22nd was hitting 196 going into that game, and he had an OPS of 563. He started pretty slow, and if you note, I was pretty quiet during those days because I didn't have much to talk about and wasn't sure what to do with myself, and I was kind of questioning my own life, really. But since that day, he's hitting 322, and his on-base is 452, which I think is the most impressive thing. But what was interesting about that game on the 23rd when he started hitting is that he actually only had one at-bat in that game. He went 1-for-1, and he walked four times, three standard walks and one intentional walk. And it raised his on-base percentage from 286 to 328 in one game. And ever since that day, he's hit 322, 452 on base, 1,062 OPS, with 17 walks and 15 strikeouts. And we're getting relatively close to a month now. It's about three full weeks where he has walked more than he struck out, which is an amazing sign for a 22-year-old shortstop. He's also got 9 extra base hits, 3 home runs, 2 triples, and 4 doubles in that time. He does have an elevated BABIP of 390, which will come down, but I think that we're seeing the makings of a superstar, sort of a Manny Machado-like breakout here with the bat. He just looks so much more comfortable, but I think this is the beginning of a superstar career for him, and I think this first 3-week stretch is his coming out party. Not like that. Don't get too excited, Joel.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with everything you said. And the interesting things that I noted when I was doing research for my piece on him was that a lot of his peripherals were exactly the same from April and May. The only thing that was really noticeably different was the BABIP. It was something like in the low 200s in April, and then in May it was like, at this point, it was like 550 or something insane. So at least up until a couple days ago, his BABIP was like 329 on the season, and I feel like that's pretty close to what it was last year. So this is, everyone's going to go through those stretches where it's higher or lower than usual, but I feel like what we're seeing out of him right now on his season numbers is kind of who he is at this point, and that's really exciting because his walk rate is up to like 14%. His strikeouts are down from like 28% last year to like 19% this year. So that's all really impressive stuff. Two important stats, I think. Maybe not important in the grand scheme, but important in context. He is leading the team in intentional walks because he's batting down near, essentially like Tim Fedorovich and David Ross. And he's also leading the team in a surprising stat, and that is seven hits to take the lead. Mm-hmm. And that's tied with Rizzo up for the team lead, and the next closest is Ben Zobrist with four. Considering he's batted seventh or eighth pretty much every single game, that's kind of a big deal, isn't it?
It is a big deal, and it's interesting because last year he hit ninth most of the year, which I kicked and screamed and cried about for the whole year. But he's being shown a lot of respect, even beyond the fact, I think, that he's had kind of weaker hitters behind him, whether it's the pitcher or Fedorovich. But there's still a lot of respect being shown, considering that most of the time a 7 or 8 hole hitting shortstop in the National League is not really strong. So it is amazing how much they don't really want to throw to him right now. And that game where he was intentionally walked, I noted that as well, as being like, man, he's ice cold. You know, he's OPSing in the 500s, and they're still intentionally walking him. That says a lot about how opposing teams feel about what he can be. So I think it says a lot. I think you're going to see it more, although today you saw him moved up to sixth in the lineup, which was really exciting for me. So that might be curtailed a bit coming forward. But it is a good sign. It's a fun sign.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a couple things are noteworthy about him. Number one, he's 22 and he's so poised. You know, that's just the word that comes to mind when I think of him. He just seems so calm all the time. And I saw him interviewed and he just has this kind of presence, you know, which is pretty astonishing for someone that age. I wouldn't be doing my part here if I didn't rain on some parade. And I will point out that he's already got four errors in 32 games, and he had four errors in 61 games last year. So at shortstop, that is, he had nine at second base. I've noticed a couple plays that he booted the ball in kind of more routine-ish plays, which is surprising because we think of him as making the routine and the spectacular. I guess, you know, that's nothing that I'm worried about. I'm just kind of pointing it out just to rain on Isaac's parade a little bit, but you know, overall,
you're terrible. you're seriously terrible.
But that's not because of this, though.
You're right. Well,
just generally.
In addition to this, he's superstar. Seems Ryan, you hear superstar and you don't flinch. You go along with that because that's a big word, and you're it's like the word brilliant. Like I don't use that too lightly. But are you
also
are you
an adjective I was used?
Only when I describe myself do I use brilliant. No.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
No, the word superstar, I think he has that kind of potential, but that's like when we talk about a player's ceiling. Sure, his ceiling is superstar, but how many players actually reach their ceiling? I don't know. I think he's very much on his way. I think he's going to be one of the best shortstops in the game.
Yeah.
And if being the third best shortstop in the game means you're a superstar, then yeah, I think he can be a superstar. I don't see him being better than Correa. I see him possibly on par with Lindor. So take that for what it means. I wanted to draw it back, though, to your points on the defense. And obviously, you kind of threw errors out as kind of a, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but that's not the best measure of defense. But
sure, right.
Fielding runs above average. I checked that today, and he's negative 2.9 on the season. And I know Baseball Prospectus didn't like him last year, and Pecota didn't like him coming into this year. So I'll move that over to you, Isaac. What's your take on that? Why do you think that is?
Well, it's weighted pretty heavily towards the errors. So the four errors are skewing that pretty hard, because if you look at some of the other metrics like Baseball Reference, they still have him as a 0.6 DWAR just for this year. So that's a lot to accumulate in a month's worth of games. I think that it's just a difference in the metrics. And he's had a few errors, and some of them weren't great, but I expect that to be a little bit more of a blip than anything, because I think he's probably more like the defensive player that he was last year. But Joel, I think you said he had 4 errors in 60-some games last year. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. 61. This is at shortstop. He had 4. He had 9 in 86 games at second base.
Yeah, and honestly, the 4 errors at 61 games at shortstop isn't really very sustainable, if you ask me. That's a number that he's probably not going to duplicate very often, because it's a really low total for that amount. That's about, what is that? That's about 11 over a full season, which is really, really low. So he's not a 4 error in 30 games shortstop, but I would say that if you take the next, you know, 4 segments of 30 games, he's probably not going to do that again.
Well,
I think he's solid. I think his errors, hands are good. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and errors, I wanted to just kind of interject. The reason I say not the best measure, and this is a thing you guys know, but maybe we can clear this up for the listeners, what that means. I remember a while back, Alex Gonzalez with the Cubs had a season where he had a very low error total at shortstop. And 16-year-old Ryan thought, oh, man, why is that guy not getting the gold glove? He's getting screwed. He never makes an error at shortstop. But it's because he made plays on everything that was hit right at him, but his range wasn't great. So he wasn't ranging really far to his right and having to make a tough throw over to first base that maybe ended up, you know, bouncing away from the first baseman or going over the first baseman's head. And that's where a lot of shortstops will get their errors. And that was kind of the knock on Derek Jeter for the longest time, was he was getting a lot of errors early in his career by essentially having a ton of range. So that is where, I guess when you say 11 errors isn't sustainable for him, I agree, because he does have so much range and he is such a good defensive player that he's going to rack up some errors just by being so good.
Yeah, I think you're right. The only part of his defensive game that I think is probably below average is his arm. I think his arm is probably in the bottom 10 or whatever for short stops in the game.
I agree with that, yeah.
I think his range is probably slightly above average to above average, and I think his hands are well above average. So I think he's an above average defensive shortstop today, and like you said earlier, I think his ceiling is probably a top 5 defensive shortstop or something like that. But one thing I wanted to point out, I'm not sure which one of you said it, but Ryan, I think you did, about go-ahead or game-winning hits that he's got. His clutch stats, and I know I sound like a BFIB right now, but his clutch stats for a 22-year-old are unbelievable. If you look at his 2 outs with runners in scoring position, he's slugging .571. Late and close, he's slugging .667. Everything that's clutch, everything within 3 runs, he is OPSing over 1,000. The only thing that he's struggling with is the stat margin greater than 4 runs, so games that are a blowout. He's actually got 27 plate appearances in games that the Cubs were ahead by 4 or more runs. He has 1 hit in those games. He's 1-for-27 with a slugging of .043. So in games that there has been any sort of leverage position, he's been absolutely awesome. And then in moments where there's basically nothing on the line, he's been awful. So the sample sizes are in the 50, 60, 70s, and 100 plate appearance ranges on these, and it's pretty amazing how great he's been in clutch situations and how awful he's been in non-clutch situations. Do you guys make anything of that?
So maybe they just need to stop blowing teams out.
Yeah, right.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Joel.
Well, I was just going to say that in today's game, so they were down 2-1, and it was the bottom of the ninth, and there were 2 outs, and Hayward was at second, and Zobrist was up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, no, Zobrist is well, but I saw Russell. Russell was in the on-deck circle, and I was like, oh, man, that's the guy I want at the plate. I was hoping that Zobrist would walk or something, you know, just to get, or, you know, maybe hit a double to bring Hayward in and then get in scoring position himself, because I was like, Russell is the guy who I want up at bat in this situation.
Yeah, I was looking at that thinking Zobrist is the guy I want up because he's so patient and he has the high contact rates. So I knew if he swung, he was putting the ball in play. But I also knew that if he took a walk, it was okay because we had Russell coming up next. And, you know, that could be potentially ending the game with like a gapper or something. Yeah, I liked your clutch comments, though, and that you're drawing it back to the BFIB. I was going to say, maybe if he keeps it up long enough, we need to change his name to, like, Bucky Russell or Skip Russell or something more scrappy than Addison.
Yeah.
Well, I just, it's amazing, though. I just, to boil it down, his ahead, as in ahead in the game, the Cubs are ahead in the game. He has 83 plate appearances, and he's hitting 176. In times when the Cubs have been behind, he has 27 plate appearances and he has 10 hits. He's hitting .435 and slugging .609. It's pretty hard to believe.
Those are all very interesting stats, but I think before anyone makes assumptions about what you're trying to say there, I think we all should, you know, just kind of throw out, that's probably just a small sample size kind of thing. Like, that's got to be, you know, unless you can tell me something that you think is, you know, actually swaying that, I would just assume that that's just kind of a sample of a month kind of luck thing.
Well, yes, 90% of me agrees with that. And then there's 10% that thinks about what Joe Maddon says about Addison Russell, which is that he doesn't need coached. He said last year, he goes, I can't tell him anything because he already knows. And he talked about his maturity and his approach and all these different things where he said he's ready to go. He's ready to go. So I just think that it does say maybe something early in the year for a 22-year-old player that the moments have not overwhelmed him. If this was the opposite, it would be easier. It would be fairly easy to say, you know, he looks like he's getting overwhelmed by the moment, because that does happen. You know, you can say somebody's not clutch or it's not a measurable stat, and that's mostly true. But there are certainly guys who get overwhelmed by moments, and Addison Russell has proven early on that that's not going to happen to him. And I think that says a lot about his character and the makeup of the type of player that he is.
I mean, you can see it in his plate approach that, you know, he's hitting those homers to left, but he was hitting the triples and his, you know, extra base hits to right field. Like, he's going the other way, so he's going with whatever he's getting. And that's the kind of thing that you just, you know, you wish you saw that more out of Baez, and you wish you saw that more of, like, say, you know, Alcantara, you know, like, so he's just kind of learning on the fly and doing all the things that you want to see a player doing. And he's 22, and he's, you know, ridiculously poised and composed, and I didn't want to say it, but I mean, we're all thinking it, dreamy, you know, whatever. I saw an interview with him, and he just seems so thoughtful, you know, and he just seems very patient,
intelligent.
And, yeah, so you know,
he comes off as very intelligent, I think.
So.
Unlike this podcast.
Yeah, well, what do you expect out of three writers from Baseball Prospectus? Right, it's not going to be that. It's not intelligent.
We do what we know can. That. You know.
the interesting thing that I'll tease for my piece on Russell that's coming out tomorrow, so it'll be about the same time this podcast is I broke down the at-bat where he hit the three-run homer off of Francisco Liriano. And
on Sunday?
Yes. And I hope I'm completely stealing your thunder on that bat of the week right here. He got to 2-2 in the count, and Liriano threw him a pitch that was just barely inside and the high part of the zone. So it just missed. And Russell laid off the pitch. And the next pitch, Liriano threw him an 86-mile-an-hour changeup high in the zone, and Russell took it out halfway up the bleachers. That is that pitch that he laid off that was ball three is a pitch that he would have struck out on last year. And I think that was the perfect snapshot of this is how he's changed as a hitter. He laid off that pitch to get the next one.
There's no question that's true. And I guess that speaks a little bit to his poise and just how quickly he's learning and adapting. And that's why I feel somewhat safe saying I feel like we've witnessed the kind of the dawning or the unearthing of what I believe is a superstar. And I believe that he was a superstar since about 3 years ago when I first saw him in the A's system. But seeing what he's put together this year is pretty rewarding. It's pretty culminating for folks like us that follow the minor leagues and watch people come up through rookie ball and low A and even in other systems. But watching it on the big league stage in Wrigley and hitting home runs off Cub killers like Francisco Liriano, it's pretty special.
Yeah, And just kind of wrap it and transition a little, you said the word superstar again. So I'm going to move on to the Cubs' bona fide superstar, Jake Arrieta. Steven Strasburg signed an extension this week, which was a little bit of a surprise to everybody, considering he's a Boris client, and he was healthy, pitching well, and head and shoulders above everybody else on the pitching market in free agency this next offseason. So because he did that, everybody decided to jump and start talking about Jake Arrieta again. And Arrieta made some very thoughtful comments where I think he was honest but not brutish with his comments, where he kind of said, you know, he has a very strong interest in staying in Chicago, but he's also not going to give a hometown discount. Joel, what do you think about that? What are your feelings on the Cubs and working out a deal with Arrieta?
Well, I mean, you know, I think personally, I've got a head and a heart thing going with that. I mean, my heart says keep him here forever. You know, like I want him on the team, and I want him to be the Cubs, you know, with a star with them for, or this, you know, their number one, number two pitcher for the next 5 or 6 years. My head says that probably doesn't make a lot of sense, because they've got so many big contracts coming up down the road. You've got Bryant, you just, you know, for starters, you've got Russell, etc. They're going to need more to keep money. You know, Wrigley Field is kind of a cash cow, but, you know, they're never going to beat the Yankees. They do have to keep their eyes on their bottom line, and I just don't know economically if it makes sense to sign him to a big extension. And I mean, I know we're getting way ahead of things because he's signed for another year, so it's kind of a moot issue, but I know that people are talking about it. I guess my feeling is that at this point, it's hard to say this, but I would think that it probably isn't the best thing for them to do.
This is an incredibly interesting question, and I think it's one that very intelligent baseball people could highly disagree on what it looks like. But I'm going to take the other side of this from what Jake Arrieta is kind of publicly saying. And I think there's a lot of risk for Jake Arrieta in not signing an extension, because if the Cubs came out and offered him, say, including next year, 6 years and $160 million, it's buying out his last arbitration year, which are we saying between 17 and 20 million next year? It's a little bit of a hard number to peg, but is that fair?
Yeah, I was going to say 15 to 18, somewhere in there.
Yeah, so if you say that he's going to make 15 and then he makes 28 a year for the 5 years beyond that, that's 140 million, and then let's call it 17. So you're talking 157 million plus, you know, maybe a signing bonus. So call it $160 million over 6 years, including next year, this final year of arbitration. He's going to be 32 when he hits the market, and if he has 3 months of attrition next year after the All-Star break, his value could plummet, because Jake Arrieta is not Roger Clemens. He's having a Pedro Martinez-like run, and I appreciate that, and I have loved it, and I've personally benefited from being able to write about it, and I have a lot of admiration for who Jake Arrieta is, but I believe that there's a lot more risk in his delivery, in his track record, in his career arc than people realize, maybe even than he realizes. And if the Cubs came out and offered him 6 years and $160 million, I think Jake Arrieta should take that. And I think that's about the very cap that I would want to see the Cubs offer. I don't want to see him go any higher than that, and even that makes me a little bit squeamish. But I'm probably in the minority when I say that I don't think it would take too much for the wheels to come off next year at some point for Arrieta and for his value to just plummet on the open market.
So what's the saying? Is it the star that burns brightest burns fastest?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically kind of what you're saying there, and I agree with that. It's I've written before about the slider cutter that he throws, the cut slider, whatever you want to call it.
That's what we want to call it.
Yeah. I've written before about the toll that takes on arms, and elbows and the strain that that goes with that. There's no reason to say he's 100% headed for Tommy John surgery at some point in his career. We don't know about that. And there's not enough science yet on that to say that pitch necessarily is like a 100% you're going to end up if you use it above this percentage. But that all said, that's a real concern with him because of that pitch. The pitch that makes him so good could, in effect, shorten his career, either through wear and tear or injury. All of that together mixed with his age, which he started really this run at an advanced age for essentially a prospect. So everything put together, I just didn't see how an extension ever worked out or made sense for either side. After last year, did you really feel all that comfortable after seeing what he did, not seeing it into this season? Did you feel all that comfortable giving him that kind of deal in the offseason? No, I didn't. I didn't think that would have been a smart move for the Cubs. He could have come out this year and had something awful happen based on, you know, all the extra innings he threw last year. So they needed to get into this season to be able to see him come back and be strong and do this whole thing again and be an ace again. But once I got into this year, now an extension talk, he's only got one more year to free agency. And he's already said he doesn't want to do a hometown discount. So what incentive is there for him now to do a deal when he's so close to getting that Yankee money? So that's where I am on it.
Yeah, and that's one way to look at it. And if he was a hitter and that had kind of broken out late, maybe a Joey Votto type or something like that, I would agree with you. But a couple things about Arrieta. For one, he doesn't have pinpoint command. And I know during this run he has shown it, but I don't think that's something that he's going to have moving forward as kind of a legacy, a legacy in his favor is pinpoint command. So I just look at him and there's the injury risk, and I sort of hate to use this example, but Jake Arrieta hasn't made all that much money in his career for a baseball player, and that sounds crazy probably to everyone listening, myself included, but he really hasn't made that much money in perspective. And for me, if the team that he was playing on and that he knows is going to be very, very good for the next 6 years comes out and says, look, Jake, we're going to give you generational money upon money upon money upon money, you know, $160 million. We're not going to give you $200. You're not going to be the highest paid player of all time. And we're going to guarantee you that money today, you know, a full 18 months before you hit free agency when you're going to be 32. The market's going to be a little bit better than it is this year. And how much sense does it make for him to wait to make an extra 20% or whatever and get $200 million? I don't know. I think his age could make people squeamish very, very quickly. There's the injury concern, and there's the fact that generational money could be offered to him today. And I think it could make some sense to secure himself right now.
I mean, I get that point, but I also think that, you know, I mean, who didn't see the writing on the wall with Albert Pujols? And who didn't see him fading? And yet the Angels threw him, you know, a truckload of money. And so, you know, I feel like there's always going to be some dumb team that's like, here's a blank check, sign, please take our money. So, you know, I know he's older, but, and I mean, we're kind of assuming, I guess a lot of it is based on what he does next year. So, you know, he's clearly, he's still an ace. We're seeing a little regression here and there, you know, with the walks, but he also has a no-hitter a couple games ago. So, you know, I guess that I see your point, though, about how he, if the Cubs come to him with a decent offer, he might be smart to take it. So I think maybe what he was saying before about he's not going to give the team a hometown discount, maybe that's just smart leveraging. You know?
Sure, yeah. That's who he is, too, right? He's the guy that's always going to say kind of the, you know, the hard thing like that. And I like that. I love that about him. But I just don't think you can compare Albert Pujols, who is a legend, he's an all-time legend, to a guy like Arrieta that's done it for 2 years, especially at such an advanced age for a pitcher. I think it's apples and oranges. I hear your point, but... And you know what? I think Arrieta agrees with you. I don't think he's blowing smoke when he says, no hometown discounts, I'm going to hit free agency and all these things. I'm just not sure that's the right thing. I think it might make more sense for him to... But I'm fairly conservative. You know, I look at it and I think, okay, next year, he could come out and have a good year. He could go on the DL for for 30 days with a sore elbow, he could come back and pitch fine and even prove that he was healthy after the sore elbow and have a 3 ERA. What's that going to do to his value? You know, because he's not a 1.5 ERA or whatever he is right now. I don't know. It's a really interesting topic.
I try and put myself in his shoes, and when I hear him say no hometown discount, I think this guy is an athlete. He is in insane shape. I mean, he has his own workout routines that he's sculpted over the last 5 years where he's, you know, doing Pilates and eating nothing but kale and baked chicken breasts. And I mean, this guy is just incredibly taken care of his body and built up his stamina so that he can withstand a season like last year and then come back and still look great this year. So in his mind, and Len Casper kind of put it this way on the broadcast when he was pitching the other day, Jake Arrieta is the guy who is always better at you than in everything. He's the guy that you could be like, hey, you ever play ping pong? And he'd say no. And you say, well, I've been playing 10 years. Let's play. And then he would kill you in it. I mean, he's just that kind of guy. So I can totally see where he looks at himself and he says, why shouldn't I, you know, stick it out another year and a half and get to free agency and get $200 million plus?
Yeah, I mean, look at Samardzija. You know, I mean, we all thought, oh, yeah, he's not going to get huge money. He got huge money. You know, I mean, I do think there's always some team that's going to be dumb, you know, and the Cubs contract with Lester, 6 years, like, I think that they knew that they're going to get 2, maybe 3 good years out of him, and then after that, it's going to fade. And I think that that's what teams would be banking on with Arrieta, that they're going to give him, you know, 6 years, and they're going to get 2, maybe 3 years. And yes, he's older, but he's also, you know, Superman with the Pilates and the yoga and the Tai Bo and whatever, you know, his workouts are legendary. So I think that I just feel that he would probably, like Ryan is saying, he will probably bet on himself, thinking, I can kick ass, I will continue to kick ass, and I'm going to go for as much money as I can. And I think that some team will pay that.
I'm curious at hearing this. What is the maximum for you guys, if you're the Cubs, that you would offer him today?
I don't really have a number. I honestly don't.
Come on, I put a number out there.
I know you did, but if I'm the Cubs, from the Cubs side of it, the number you put out seems fine. 6 years, buyout the last arbitration year, $160 million. I might go as high as $180 over 7 years, but that would 7 years is kind of stretching it for me. So at that point, you know you're paying for like 3 or 4 dead years, but you're also paying, you know, at this point, to try and get age 33, 34 out of them. So, I don't know. At this point, this is really unpopular. At this point, I'm all about getting every single ounce you can out of him this year and next year, and then hoping that you have other stuff lined up after that to continue that window with the rest of the core. I'd be fine with letting him go if he's going to get a huge contract.
You know, it's funny because I just think that it would be so nerve-wracking to be a GM, because you would look at this situation and you'd think, okay, well, who do we have in the pipeline next? We've got Cease, for instance. You know, he's good, but is he going to be that good? And then who else is going to be available on the free agent market? And then who can we trade? Torres, what can we get for him? And, like, you just – the scenarios, I would never sleep, because I'd be like, you know, Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind with all these figures and stats coming at me and players all the time trying to figure it out. And I would just go crazy.
You just said Russell and Beautiful in the same sentence, and I got distracted. Side note, yeah. I just lost my fantasy second baseman for the next several weeks because he just cold cocked Jose Bautista during a game. That was awesome. Did you guys see that?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yes.
That was incredible.
It was the best. It was the best baseball punch I've ever seen. I think at least going back to Nolan Ryan and Robin Ventura.
Did you ever see Jack McDowell? Yes. Who was the guy? I forget the guy. I can see him, but the guy came out and McDowell didn't react, and the guy just absolutely just blasted him and right and right in the face, and it was really bad. But I can't remember the guy's name. Witten, Mark Witten, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right. But Odor, and he's not a very big guy. Bautista is quite a bit bigger than he is, and he almost just knocked him out. I think that was ice cold. That was pretty great.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but
I think he kind of just took him. I think he took him by surprise because I think the look on Bautista's face. I think he was ready to get up in Odor's face, and that punch. I think he looked really surprised. Like, it knocked his sunglasses off his face. I mean, it was. I don't think he was expecting that at all.
Wow, that was fun.
Yeah, Deadspin made a gif of it. So.
Well, I guess speaking of no punch, let's talk about Jason Hayward.
Oh, that's low.
Oh, come on.
That's give good, me, but low.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with it. Go on.
I was going to say his stats for the last week, it's getting a lot better. He was 1-for-4 today, but his previous 8 games coming in, .375 batting average, .443 on base. Problem I'm still having with Hayward, even if the hits are falling in, he is hitting essentially nothing more than 5 feet off the ground. Everything is either line drive on the ground or slow ground ball. He's got 5 extra base hits on the season. So I guess let's talk about Hayward. Even if he is getting on base at a .440 clip the last 8 or 9 games, are we still concerned about what we're seeing from him?
Well, I mean, I know there's the thoughtful, patient, cerebral response, which is, no, of course, we've got a sample size that shows that he is going to increase his extra base hits and be a better player. But the meatball in me is kind of going crazy. I mean, all we're seeing, like you said, is liners, strikeouts, or liners to the second baseman. And sometimes they get through, but sometimes they don't. And it's starting to kind of drive me crazy a little bit. You know, I saw him today when in the first inning, Fowler's on second, and he comes up and he strikes out a pitch at his eyeballs. And I know, again, that's just one at bat, and again, that's very meatballish. But there's part of me that's like, Jesus, man, come on. It's the middle of May. I don't know if you can say it's early anymore. It's early-ish, but enough time has passed. I know the numbers are reflecting improvement, but like you said, 5 doubles for a guy who looks like he's sculpted out of granite. And I remember someone saying, like, don't look at him like he looks like he does. You know, look at him like he's Darwin Barney. That's my own metaphor there. But like, I can't remember who said it, but said, don't look at him like he's this big guy because he doesn't play like he looks. Okay, fine. But when you're right fielder and Bartolo Colon has more homers than you do, that's bad. That's just plain bad. So I'm starting to get a little frustrated with it.
Yeah, I think you said the last 8 games hitting .375, which is what I was going to say. His BABIP is .429 in that time, and that's too high, but it was also a correction of a really poor BABIP before that. So it's discouraging not to see him have any extra base hits during that time. But what I look at that's actually encouraging to me is that his approach seems to have changed. He's got 5 walks in the last – coming into today. He's got 5 walks in the last 4 games. So to me, that says that he's seeing the ball better and he's having better at-bats, where that was actually the most troubling thing to me. Not that he wasn't driving the ball as much, but his plate discipline seemed a little bit off in the beginning of the year. So seeing the 5 walks in the last 5 games was really encouraging. It's still a guy that he's not really hitting the ball with authority yet, but a couple of things bring me some solace here. He's always started slow, which I think you pointed out last week, Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't know why, but timing is a huge thing in baseball, and some guys just can't get it going until they've seen a lot of pitches. So he's always started slow. He started slow again. His on-base percentage is .347. For as bad as he's hit, he's still getting on at a great clip. He's walking 13% of the time, which is an excellent stat. He's only striking out 17% of the time. So the strikeout-to-walk ratio is still really, really strong, really positive. And, I mean, 347 on base, he's not going to hit 236 all year. He's just not. So that means that that on base is probably going to continue to creep up, and you know you're going to see him finish in the 360 to 380 range where he's been his whole career. So frankly, I'm not really worried. I think he's a slow starter, and I think we'll see him hitting line drives all over the field very shortly.
My other question I wanted to ask on him, and you kind of led right into it with the on base and the fact that he's hit so poorly, and yet he still has a 347 on base. And with that walk rate, you would expect that's only going to go up as the hitting does improve. But with the lack of power, and not just this year, but also historically for him, the new book on sculpting a lineup says you want an on base guy who bats for contact in the leadoff spot. And you don't mind if you get strikeouts out of the guy hitting second, but you want, a guy with a little bit more pop in his bat.
Yeah.
Would you consider at this point in the season, if you were Joe Maddon, putting Hayward leadoff, Fowler second?
No, I wouldn't. I like Fowler leading off too much, especially being a switch hitter. I love Fowler leading off. I think he's pretty much the ideal leadoff hitter in the game right now. But what I would do is I would consider moving up Ben Zobrist to second. I think he's pretty much an ideal number two hitter, especially with as hot as he's been. And then I wouldn't mind seeing Hayward maybe drop to either sixth or seventh if you want to hit Russell sixth. So you could drop Hayward in the lineup. But Zobrist is the only guy that I think I would move to two. I like Bryant and Rizzo in the 3-4, and I like Fowler at the 1. So I wouldn't move those guys, but I can definitely see moving Hayward down a bit in the lineup to get somebody with hitting the ball with more authority in the second hole.
And to clarify on that, I was talking about as he starts to regress back to his normal stats, him going to the leadoff spot, not as punishment isn't the right word, but I'm not talking about switching him just because he's struggling. Whereas if he starts hitting, like he has in the second half the last several years, I don't know if I'd want him down in the sixth or seventh spot with that. Is that what you're saying? Or
I was more saying just for present day. I really like the idea of Zobrist hitting second because he doesn't strike out. Really, he's a pretty similar profile to Hayward, but he's just so much hotter right now that I would love to see him a little bit higher in the lineup. He's been hitting fifth, so that's pretty high. But seeing Zobrist lead off the other day for the first game, I think, of the doubleheader was really fun. But I love Fowler in the 1, and then Zobrist in the 2, I think, could be really fun. But as for Hayward, I don't care too much what they do with him. If they continue to hit him second, I feel fine about it because I just have quite a bit of faith that at the end of the year we'll look up and he'll have hit 265 to 275 and his on base will be 360 to 370 where it seems to be pretty much every year. I just don't see that much deviation in what he's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. I guess that everything you said makes sense, and I agree with it, but there is, like I said, there is just part of me that's just frustrated and wants to see him, I don't know how many times, I've been to a couple games in the past few weeks, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, all right, this is it, this is going to be his first homer, and it, clearly isn't, and I'm just a little frustrated with it, but I know bigger picture, the team is putting up historic numbers, getting little to nothing from, getting nothing is, he does have a strong on base percentage, so yes, that's overstating it, but getting not a lot from their corner outfielders. So assuming he starts to come around, like everything just feels like such a bonus when, you've got him, and then, I don't know, we've talked about Soler and what happens there, but you figure you're going to get more from both of those, and that's just going to be, they're just going to be even better, and that's just, to me, very exciting.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. That's a bad way to segue, isn't it?
Mic drop.
All right, so Joel, you brought up you wanted to do kind of a new segment, so I'm just going to call it Joel's unofficially titled segment, I Wonder.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain what this is to the listener and how we're going to go about doing this going forward?
Okay, so you know, we'll give this a shot and see how it goes. And we've got, you know, millions of listeners all across the globe, and I'm sure they will bombard us with emails if they don't feel like it works out. But what I just thought was that each week one of us could come up with a question and then throw it out and ask the other people here on the podcast, and we can get kind of an organic talk, and you know, you wouldn't know what the question would be, so you'd have to come up with something off the cuff. So a way to kind of bring up a topic that isn't maybe something that would come up just by something that's happened over the past week, and just, you know, see how it goes. So this is with that as the throat clearing intro. I'll just start with the question for the first week, which is, I wonder who would be the most devastating injury for the Cubs other than Anthony Rizzo or Jake Arrieta? So I'll start, and I would say, to my mind, it would be John Lester, because I feel like Arrieta is who he is, and Lester, you know, we saw him today. He had a no-hitter, what, into the seventh? And, you know, it's just a great 1-2 combo. And Hendricks and Hamill have been solid, certainly, and Lackey, too, for the most part. But I feel like, you know, it's held together with, it's kind of MacGyvered with chewing gum and paper clips and hairspray. And so there's part of me that feels like if everything switched, if it had to slide because you lost Lackey, that would definitely be that would be a big hit. So mine would be John Lackey. That would be the biggest injury for the team, not Rizzo or Arrieta.
Lester. You mean Lester, right? John Lester.
Yes. Oh, did I say, who did I say?
You said Lackey.
Oh, yeah, I meant Lester. Thanks.
Yeah. When you said that, when you said other than Anthony Rizzo or Jake Arrieta, the first place my mind went was John Lester. And correct me if I'm wrong, are there any better 1-2 pitching punches in Major League Baseball right now than John Lester and Jake Arrieta?
Yeah, maybe on the south side of town. It's very close.
Man,
Sail and
how about
Katana.
that, huh?
Yeah, that's about as close as you get, right? And Pakoda had it that way at the start of the season, where I think it was by WARP, Arrieta and Lester were like number 3 and number 6 or something like that in Pakoda. So that's where my mind goes. If I'm gonna go with anybody other than Lester, I would say Dexter Fowler. Because if you look at the Cubs' record since the All-Star break last year, when they really took off, or just after the All-Star break, Fowler hitting really well, and you know the whole Madden you go, we go kind of thing. He really took off with the bat then, and has continued it into this season. So I'd be really interested, hopefully a question I never have to see answered, but I'd be interested to see if he had to go down for a long period of time, what that would do to them.
That's interesting. And my mind actually went somewhere else, and that was to Chris Bryant, because I think he's the next best player, and I don't think it's terribly close after Arrieta and Rizzo. I think it's Bryant. But when you said Lester, I thought through that and thought, yeah, he's pretty much indispensable to this team. He really is. And then after that, as I was thinking about other guys, Dexter Fowler's the guy that came to mind. He was. Bryant is the hardest to replace because he's the best player, but Fowler is so indispensable to this team. The way he has set the tone so often and just crushed the ball, and he's been on base constantly in the second half of last year, all the way up, you know, it just carried right through. So I love that point. I think he's probably a close second or third, call it third in my mind, behind Bryant and Lester. But mine, I think, would be Chris Bryant. And I know he's not hitting quite as well right now, but that's a guy that's just absolute stalwart at three. And I think if you take him out of this lineup, things would change more than anybody realizes. I think he's a much bigger cog than anybody realizes in the lineup. Pitchers are terrified of him, and he works such deep counts. I feel like he's taking 6, 7, 8 pitches all the time. And yeah, I think my answer is Chris Bryant.
You know, the thing I thought about Bryant too, but my thought was, well, you've got Javier Baez there. So, I mean, I know that Baez is a completely different kind of player, but maybe, you know, it's not such a devastating loss. I think Fowler's a good call. I had one other name come to mind too, and let me just run this past you guys. Hector Rondon.
Not even close for me.
I mean, I don't know that he's number one, but I think he's up there. Because okay, so if he goes down, then who's your closer?
Strope.
Yeah,
but I mean, I don't know. Does he give you a lot of confidence?
Not necessarily, but I don't know. I feel like between Strope, Warren, Grimm, Wood,
Neil
Ramirez,
arms.
I feel like you could call up C.J. Edwards.
Right.
You could call up Armando Rivero if need be. That guy's got an electric arm. You got plenty of options there, and plus I think trading for relievers is about the easiest thing you can do when you're talking about trades. So yeah. I feel like the depth is enough there that you can replace the guy who comes in the ninth inning with nobody on and gets three outs. I think you can replace that fairly easily on this team. Not to diminish what Rondon does, because he's been fantastic, but I think that is an area you can improve much more easily than you could like the number two starter.
Yeah, and just to speak to your point about Baez, it's a luxury to have Baez to be able to back up Bryant, but a few things. Baez has done well this year, mainly sort of like Listella, where Madden has put him in pretty advantageous spots for him to succeed. And yeah, he's a blast to watch play third base. I absolutely relish watching him play defense, but the other thing is if Baez is in the game, you lose your versatility. And if Bryant's hurt and Baez is playing every day, that really limits the bench big time, and it limits the versatility of what you can do. That means Soler is probably out and left virtually every day, which is not a positive right now. So I think I'd stick with my answer there.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, that was a good first I wonder segment.
No, it Joel, wasn't. It's centered around negativity and injury, just like we expected it to.
Next time you can be like, I wonder what kind of unicorn, what color unicorn Addison Bryant flies around on. I say yellow.
Wait, did you just make them like a super player, Addison Bryant? I think you did.
Okay, I'll go with that. Yeah, that's the next level.
All right, so since Carlos isn't around and Joel just went with the I Wonder segment, I'm going to bump 60 seconds to the last segment, and we're going to go, just going to switch it up a little bit. Isaac, why don't you lead away with the at-bat of the week?
I will do that, and this week's at-bat of the week is not actually an at-bat. It is a plate appearance for the purists out there, but in yesterday's game, yesterday being Saturday as we record this on Sunday night, the Cubs were trailing 2-0 in the fourth inning of a game that looked like it might be low scoring. It was cold. It was very cold, actually, and windy. It was blowing in. The wind was blowing from left to right, but mainly in. Jeff Locke looked fairly good, actually. He was hitting the corners inside and outside. So 2-0, Locke was rolling. Jason Hayward led off the fourth inning with a squibber between pitcher and second base that he beat out, hustled down the line and beat out the throw for an infield single. And then Chris Bryant came up. So it's pretty innocuous. Nobody out, one on, fourth inning, down 2-0 on a tough pitcher's day. Bryant quickly got down 0-2 on two fastballs. One was outside the zone, which he fouled off, and the other was a called strike right at the top of the zone. It was kind of high. I remember seeing it and thought, that's kind of high. But Bryant's pretty tall. He got it called on him, down 0-2 really quickly. So the third pitch he took, it was inside, well inside. The fourth pitch was very borderline. It's one of those pitches that if it had been 2 inches farther inside, it probably would have been a strike or maybe an inch or two lower, but it was kind of high and kind of outside. Pitch FX actually has it in the strike zone as a strike, but he took it. It was a great take to get to 2-2, and then he took two pitches not all that close for ball four. That's my at-bat of the week because it pushed Jason Hayward to second. Bryant took first. He worked a six-pitch at-bat on a cold day. Does anybody remember who the next batter was?
Anthony Rizzo.
Anthony Rizzo, and he hit a majestic launched home run deep into right field to go ahead 3-2, which was the game winner. They never looked back. They won 8-2, but Today's at-bat of the week is actually a plate appearance, and it's the six-pitch walk that Chris Bryant forced after going 0-2-4-2 to allow Anthony Rizzo to hit a three-run homer.
We need to get these segments sponsored. You know, like the Timex 60 seconds with a former Cub, and, you know, I don't know who would be the at-bat of the week, but...
The Louisville Slugger at bat of the week.
There you go. Perfect.
The Under Armour at bat of the week.
The Express. Let's just throw
Nike, Apple. Let's just throw names out there. Maybe one of them will give us some money. Toyota, Ford, Volkswagen.
The Sloan question of the week.
Yeah.
Just anything with Joel. The Sloan Joel segment.
The Saks underwear segment of the week.
All right, well, then I guess that takes us to our question of the week, which this one comes from a questioner who describes himself as simply Carlos's Guatemalan love song.
Wow.
And he asks, what is the area the Cubs need to improve upon at the deadline? Are there any names you'd target in that spot? I know where I would go with that, but I'll leave that up to you guys. Joel, you first. What is your ideal improvement at the trade deadline?
I mean, the only thing that comes to mind immediately is middle relief. I don't see any other holes that really need to be addressed. Depth is fine. Starting pitching. I mean, I guess you can never have too much starting pitching. You know, everyone's been talking about Sonny Gray. I don't know. I mean, if Hamill holds up, I feel like you're probably good there. I feel like bullpen help. And that, you know, I feel like they're in a good position too because they've got so much depth in the minors that, like Isaac, you said earlier, trading for bullpen arms is a pretty easy thing to do. So that's what I would look at. And I don't have a name off the top of my head, but I just feel like a couple more you know, I don't know what is. I meant to mention this earlier. I don't know what's going on with Neil Ramirez. If he's in the witness protection plan or what. But you know, another power arm or two in there would make me feel a lot better. And Travis Wood, I feel like seeing him in high leverage situations is just my nervousness level is growing each time. So I would not mind seeing another lefty in there and then maybe a power righty, and then I don't know. I don't see anything else. Nothing else is jumping out at me.
This is a tough question because the team is, 18 games over 500. They've been completely dominant and are just crushing everyone in run differential, so you're kind of nitpicking anything that you do. But first thing I would say is starting pitching because you can never have enough pitching, and that is incredibly cliche, but the odds that these five guys throw the entire season healthy is very low. And we've talked about how they're specifically, individually, they have a high odds to pitch through the season, but the odds that one of them goes down is high. So a starter, definitely a two or another three starter, I think would be big, but the only other area that I can really see it in, as well as the bullpen, I agree, Joel, but is left field. You can't keep running Soler out there forever, and I like him as much as the next guy, his potential, but you don't want that guy out in the field right now in a playoff game, not right now. So maybe one of these bats that might be out there that could play left field and hit at a really high level could be quite interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would agree with that.
And those are the two places, left field and the bullpen, that I was thinking as well. I was thinking about specifically a left-hander in the bullpen. Although Adam Warren has somewhat reverse splits, so you can run him out there as sort of a loogie if need be. But I'm just not inspired by Clayton Richard at this point.
No.
I was thinking about Jake McGee, who got traded to Colorado, and I mean that just seemed sort of like an obvious he was going to be re-dealt at the trade deadline for Colorado to get prospects. But the Rockies are in a piss poor division and doing not as bad as I think everybody thought they would. And Jake McGee in general hasn't been pitching so hot. I think his strikeouts are way down early this year. So I don't know exactly who's out there at this point for like a left-handed reliever. That was kind of the guy that I wanted to keep my eye on all year. But
well, you know who it's going to be, right? I mean,
who?
It's going to be Aroldis Chapman. He's going to be a free agent. The Yankees are bad. They're already 10 games out of that division. They're not going anywhere fast. That team is terrible. He's going to be on the trade block. What do you do with that?
I don't know. I hadn't even thought about trading for Chapman.
That's the guy I called out a few weeks ago if we needed bullpen help, and it's looking like that he's going to be out there.
Hard not to want to bet the farm on him.
Yeah, I would think maybe, I don't know. I guess that is an option that I hadn't thought about. I just don't want to trade. I don't want to think about the Cubs trading a whole bunch of prospects or even one good prospect for a reliever. I was thinking more along the lines of like Jake McGee or somebody like that who can just fit in like a middle relief role or a loogie or somebody who comes in and you can rely on just getting a lefty out, because I think that's where they're really specific. That spot is specifically weak. If you're talking about Chapman, you're talking about trading for like a closer, and that's not necessarily. I don't think set up like. I think I'm perfectly fine with what they have at the end of the game. I'm thinking more bridging the gap.
Well, here's another thought. Then same team, same arm. Andrew Miller. He's got 2 years on his deal after this. 2.5 years this year. So he's making enough money that the Yankees might look at their window of contention and say, we're not going to be good these next 2 years. Let's shed the payroll while we can. Andrew Miller is as good as they come as well. I'd put him right up there with Chapman, but he doesn't have like the stigma of saying this is a closer, which I hate that stigma anyway. But this is a closer, so maybe you don't upset the apple cart with Andrew Miller. Does that name interest you?
Yeah, that's actually that's where I was kind of going with the Yankees. I was kind of leaning more that way. I don't necessarily think, depending on the prospect difference that they want, I'd rather go with a guy like Miller than go with a guy like Chapman, personally. Mm-hmm. The other spot in left field that I was thinking about, what do you guys think about Josh Reddick? We know that Oakland likes him a lot. He's going to be a free agent. He's having a really great year following up a fantastic year last year. Is the prospect price going to be too much? Do you think a rental for an outfielder is a smart thing to do? How would you go about it?
I love the idea of Josh Reddick. I actually kind of love the idea that he's a rental because, I mean, we've got Kyle Schwarber and he's going to come back next year. Schwarber's going to need all the time he can get in left field. So I actually really like the idea of a guy like Reddick over a guy like Braun who has 4 years left on his deal. And, you know, he's going to need to play and he can't DH, so Braun's going to be in there if you go trade for Braun. But you go get Reddick when you know that he's going to be a big upgrade for you in the left. He's got a lot of power. He's getting on base in an absurd clip this year, 383 or something like that, where I think that's going to come down. He's only a 315 career on base guy, but I think that could be a really good fit. We know these front offices like each other. I like the fact that he's a rental. I don't think the prospect cost will be that high. Maybe a bottom end top 10 guy or more like a 13 to 15 guy and then maybe another lower piece. But I think he's a very interesting name for this team.
Yeah, he's also the kind that this team likes. His base on balls percentage is he's walking at an 11% clip and striking out at 15. So, you know, that's pretty solid, good contact. I would not mind that. And I think you make a good point about the rental with Schwarber. I think that I still wonder. I think that they like Schwarber a lot, so I don't see them trading him. But I guess they're just going to make do with his defense. So I know that we had talked about that several weeks ago, whether or not they're going to trade Schwarber. I don't want to open that can of worms, but I think that's a great point that assuming they keep Schwarber, which I think they will, then you don't need a guy like Braun, and he obviously comes with a lot of baggage anyway. So I think that's a great name, and I just wonder, you know, they might have to stack the deck a little more because they fleeced the A's so bad with the Russell Samardzija trade. You know, is Billy B going to be like, no, sorry, No, sorry.
I think that's a pretty fair trade. I kind of wish they had not made that trade. Sorry. But think about adding, if you add, a couple of deals where you're probably not giving up premium prospects. Miller's going to take some prospects because he's good, but he's making enough that it's not going to be probably one of your top two or three. Maybe I'm naive there, but if you add Miller and Reddick at the deadline, that really, really strengthens the team. It lengthens the lineup. It's another left-handed bat. It's another power guy, and then it completely changes the complexion of the bullpen, in my opinion. So those are two relatively viable moves I think you could make that really would be pretty exciting for the depth of this team.
Yeah, it's a topic for another day, but I find it interesting the conversation about you're putting Schwarber in left next year, and yeah, you kind of assume that Fowler's gone. What does the outfield look like next year? Maybe that's something we bring back up next week on the podcast to tease or go a little bit deeper, and we have a little bit more time. But I mean, do you just assume that Jason Hayward is the only one in the outfield right now who's guaranteed a spot next year? I don't know. I don't know how comfortable you feel about that. Let's say the Cubs fall just short of winning the World Series this year.
How dare you?
Blasphemer.
Yeah. You go into next offseason saying, how are we going to make sure our team is better? Is bringing a guy who missed an entire season and already was a questionable left fielder, is bringing him back and putting him in left field and then calling up Al Mora to play center, is that the best idea? I don't know. But maybe that's something we talk about a little bit more next week. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting topic, although there's talk about getting ahead of yourself. But my first thought was when you were talking about that, I'm like, I don't know. It makes me a little uneasy. But, I mean, on paper, that's what you would do. But, yeah, I think that's a really interesting topic for future discussions.
But it's not all that different than this year, because Schwarber had zero experience in the outfield. We had no idea what he would give us defensively. He's going to come in and hit no matter what he's doing. So next year, the only real difference between this year and next year is the fact that there's not probably going to be a surprise signing of Dexter Fowler. But at one point, we were dead set on Jason Hayward being the center fielder and Soler being the right fielder and Schwarber being the left fielder. But two things. If you move Hayward to center, if you're saying that Almora is not ready, which I fully believe he'll be ready, but you move him to center, you've got Schwarber in left, you've got Soler in right, who we may or may not want to bank on. But the other thing is Tommy La Stella and Javier Baez are still not considered starters in that equation. So what if you decide that you want to start Tommy La Stella or you want to start Javier Baez at third? That kicks Bryant into right field, and I think we're all comfortable with that. So if you had Schwarber and Hayward and Bryant across the outfield, mm-hmm. I feel okay with that. And then you've got Baez at third. You still have La Stella on the bench. So I'm actually not that worried about it at all if Fowler leaves. I love him. I think he's been awesome. But there's a lot of options, and that doesn't even work in the fact that I think Albert Almora is your starter on opening day next year in center field.
Yeah, and that's a topic I think we can all look at a little bit more down the road when it's probably more appropriate. But it is very interesting, to say the least, the idea of next year's outfield having two out of the three completely different players. But I guess let's go into our last segment then. Joel, you have a 60 seconds with a former Cub ready for us. Are you going to make us all wet our pants again?
Look, your incontinence is your own issue there.
I already have to pee, so be careful.
No, I don't think that we can, when you've got the raw material of working with Pete LeCocq, I don't think that you can ever top that, so to speak.
Was that another pun?
I didn't mean to be, but it's kind of canon. You just can't avoid it.
You've been circumcised.
This week is Mike Harkey.
Mike Harkey. All right.
Wah.
All right.
All right.
I got the stopwatch ready. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Go.
Cubs fans had reason to be excited when the team picked 6'5" fireballer Mike Harkey with the fourth pick of the 1987 draft. Alas, there are three memorable moments in the career of the would-be ace, making less of a, hey, remember that awesome pitcher, and more of a, my God, this team and their bad luck. The first notable moment came on September 5th, 1988, on Harkey's third major league pitch. He drilled Phil Bradley in the head, sending Bradley tumbling to the ground like a bag of concrete. I remember watching that game, and Harkey looked just about catatonic afterwards. Thankfully, they both recovered, although Harkey went on to lose the game 4-3. The second was June 4th, 1990, when Harkey threw 160 pitches against the Cardinals. Incredibly, Dusty Baker was not the manager. Rather, it was Don Zimmer. The last instance occurred on September 6, 1992, in a sad bid to entertain fans, like some needy mime on the street. Harkey attempted a cartwheel in the outfield. You probably see where this is going. He blew out his knee. He was never the same, although he eventually returned to pitch three more years.
1 minute.
He's currently the bullpen coach for the New York Yankees.
Well done.
Yeah. 160 pitches. Isn't that, doesn't that blow your mind?
That seems less than good.
So I'm looking at something here. In 1990, yes, 160 pitches, and I thought the 119 Arrieta threw was bad. But in 1990, he started 27 games. He went 12-6 and had a 3.26 ERA. You're like, hey, that's pretty good, right? 3.26, 12-6, whatever. Do you care to guess what his strikeout per nine was? This is unbelievable.
4.8.
4.9, and his walks per nine were
it was so close.
3.1. He barely struck out more guys than he walked, and he still had that low of an ERA. That's pretty hard to replicate, I would think.
I'm looking at 1990. I'm looking at his pitch count: 112, 130, 101, 128, 160, 118, 146, 115. And my God, I mean, what were they thinking?
Here's the thing. In 91, he only got out to the mound four times after those pitch counts. In 92, he only got out there seven times. So he was ruined that year. He was only 23 years old in 1990, and he only made 11 combined starts the next 2 years. That says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it brings to mind that scene in Moneyball. I'm sure you guys saw the movie, where the guy's like, they're talking about drafting a guy. They're like, well, you know, his girlfriend isn't that hot, so maybe he's got bad self-esteem, so we shouldn't pick him. And like, it's like, is that what they're thinking? Like, well, he's got 143 pitches, but he's still throwing well, so let's throw him out there again. You know, there's just no foresight going on. It's just like a different universe.
Jeez, scary.
Yeah,
that's... That just, it reminds me of, like, you know, Kerry Wood in, I want to say 2003. I mean, he obviously didn't throw 160 pitches, but I think there was a game where he threw like 130 in like six innings or something like that. Something absolutely ridiculous. That whole thing, I mean, especially with young pitchers, I think the only time you ever really see that kind of thing now is with like high school kids or college kids where they're, coaches are out for their own personal glory and they just abuse the crap out of their young pitchers, but that needs to really die. That people need to be shamed into that, just getting rid of it, throwing kids out there and making them do stuff like that. I heard recently there was some kid that threw both ends of a doubleheader in high school, and there was I think a couple years ago locally here, one of the guys who writes for a local newspaper, basically there's like a Hall of Fame coach at one of the high schools, and he used one of his pitchers to get him into like the state tournament or something, and just abused the crap out of his arm, made him throw like 150 pitches between like a Friday, Saturday. And one of the local guys just ripped him apart over it, doing it, and that guy started getting like death threats to his house for doing that.
Wow.
The writer for calling it out. So, I mean, like, it's a whole culture. I mean, at the major league level, people seem to get it now, and in the minor leagues, teams are understanding it, but in high school and I guess college, they just don't get that they're ruining kids' arms.
Yeah, you know, I think that what's interesting, though, and this is, again, something for maybe another time, but I just wonder why, you know, I'm looking at Bob Gibson. I know he is a complete freak and an outlier, but I'm looking at 1970, just randomly, complete game, complete game, complete game, pitch into the seventh, complete game, shutout, complete game. Like, he pitched. Yeah, they don't have the pitch count, unfortunately. But you know, why were guys able to throw routinely so much, so many more pitches then? And I'm sure that I know that statistically, I'm sure that, you know, there were guys below their arms that we just don't know about. But it does seem like it's trending downward. And maybe that's just because we have more knowledge now that we didn't then.
I was going to say they throw harder. But the other thing that I remember hearing Tommy John talk about was before Tommy John surgery was a thing, you just were like year to year as a pitcher. And if you had a great year, that was great. The next year you could go just blow your arm out and your career was over. And so that was kind of the mentality back in the day. You didn't have the long guaranteed contracts. It was just you ran the guys out there as hard as you could, and if you ruined them, you ruined them.
Yeah. I mean, look at Koufax. Koufax was done at 30, basically. Right. Just completely done. You know, these days he'd go to 30 and then he'd have Tommy John and he'd miss a year and he'd come back and he'd pitch not as effectively, but he'd start back up at 31, 32 and throw another 4 or 5 years. So Gibson, I think, is probably just an outlier. You know, he's one of those guys that could go out there and throw and just throw and throw and throw and throw. But that's not the norm. I think there was probably, to Ryan's point, there's probably way more guys that, you know, were, and quote, ineffective at some point in their career and then just were out. Truly, they were injured, but nobody really knew it.
Right. I guess it's not fair to use Gibson and be like using, well, why do more players play like Michael Jordan, for instance?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm obviously of a younger generation. My baseball viewing started in the 90s, but I talk to older fans of baseball, and they speak very highly of all these pitchers that they thought were so great back in their era, and half the time I've never even heard of them. And I think it's just because, well, they had their 3 to 5 year run or 2 year run or whatever it was, and then after that they were just done. I think that's way more common in the 50s, 60s, 70s than it is, you know, that we have those guys now. I think pitchers are in general having, the guys who are truly great are having longer sustained periods of career success.
Yeah. Well said.
So, and on that note. Now that we're talking about pitching injuries, we should probably just stop there and say goodnight. Do you guys have anything to add to that?
No, we missed you, Daddy. Hopefully you're back next week.
Yeah. Hopefully Carlos's Fight Club moves back to their usual Friday night thing and instead of Sunday nights. And we'll have him back leading because I don't like doing it, apparently. You can find us on Twitter at BP Wrigleycast. You can email us at bpwrigleycast@baseballprospectus.com. And please give us feedback on iTunes. You can tweet us feedback. You can, you know, any way that you can contact us, you can tweet at us personally and yell at us and tell us how terrible we are. Whatever you want to do, just we love having the feedback. So thanks again for the help tonight, guys, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Good night.
Good night.